Hello, welcome to ATM, Artists Talk Movies, a podcast interviewing creatives about films that have inspired and or influenced their personal studio work. I'm Hyde Fontenot, and I'm here with co-host Aaron Stafford.
We're here to talk about contemporary art and the creative impulse with new guests each episode. We're having casual conversations.
We don't pretend to be authorities.
We're hoping to give you a window into the visionary process of makers.
Who are you?
Just your average horny little devil.
With the witches of Eastwick,
we could do things you haven't any idea.
You know what's going on up in that house?
She says she sees the devil here in Eastwick.
Hello, Aaron.
Hello.
Okay, so this is our 20th episode, isn't it?
Oh my God, it's going to be such a good one. I'm so excited for this one.
Okay, and I didn't do a lot of research because, you know, I'm not good at that sort of thing, but I did see that on the 20th anniversary, the traditional gift is China. but then I saw that there are, people observe different types of gifts depending on if it's a husband, a wife, a friendship, etc. So, I'm not sending you any china in the mail, but you never know. I might get you something.
You know, I always enjoy your random gifts. Because they're very insightful and yet totally random, and I love it.
That's very sweet. In fact, I have a bunch of critter stuff for you right now. I have a bird's nest. Oh, I have a few wasp nests. I have a few locust shells that my friend Lorraine got for you. So I have a whole bunch of stuff to dump on you.
Well, I can give you a little gift. It's of information, but I don't know if that counts.
Is this like when you leave a waiter a shitty tip and you're like, here's your tip, fella, get a haircut.
This is so much better. You'll love this. So, if you remember, on one of our recent episodes with Margot Crump, and we covered the witch. And so we've done a lot of witches. We did even Wizard of Oz is kind of witchy.
Oh, absolutely.
And then I would say Angel Heart is a little, you know, culty, right? So it's a theme that we've.
And the first, the devils,
Yeah, the devil. Oh my God, yeah, totally. So Margot recommended this book that I've been reading called Witches Slots Feminist, which has absolutely been brilliant. But one of the tidbits that stuck out in my mind, and I thought about you, was that there is, within the sort of like folklore, or urban, or these sort of legends, behind witches, it was thought that in order to indoctrinate a witch, they would have to give the sort of like kiss of shame. And if you could imagine, this of course involves kissing the devil, like asshole.
Aaron, everybody knows this. No, I'm teasing. Any Satanist worth their salt knows you've got to kiss the devil on his big brown eye.
It's so funny. I just started laughing. I think I even put hide in my notes. but it, you know, this really is so fascinating to me because it just sort of sums up the sort of like how insane all of this, you know, these ideas behind witches and the fear of witches. And it's like.
And it's all dreamt up by Christians.
Totally. So I'm so excited to talk about The Witches of Eastwick because it's been a favorite movie, but one that I hadn't seen since I was a kid. So it was kind of interesting to see it as an adult and as an artist. And so today we're joined with Angela Fraley, and Hyde, you're going to give a little introduction.
So Angela Fraley's paintings weave realism and abstraction in lush and complex compositions. These works range from intimate portraits to monumental figure painting. The artist is referencing fairy tale narratives, myths, and legends to ask how these familiar stories express and influence cultural attitudes about contemporary women and how this might shape our beliefs about race, economics, gender, and sexuality. So Angela Fraley earned her MFA from Yale School of Art and her BFA from Boston University, has had solo shows at PPOW in New York, at Inman Gallery in Houston, at Peters Projects in Santa Fe. She's exhibited at the Museum of Fine Arts in Houston, the Kemper Museum of Contemporary Art. I think that's in St. Louis or Kansas City. And has been a recipient of several awards and residencies, including Yale's Alice Kimball English Grant, the Sharp Walentis Studio Program in Brooklyn, the CORE Program in Houston, and the Bemis Center for Contemporary Arts in Omaha, Nebraska. Fraley has collaborated with curators, museum directors, and art historians, interacting with institutional collections and creating site-specific projects examining invisible histories and dormant narratives concerning gender dynamics in art history. Fraley's created these projects for the Edward Hopper Museum, the Vanderbilt Mansion Museum, the Everson Museum of Art, and the Delaware Museum of Art. And I'm scrolling down, sorry. There's a little bit left. Fraley just closed a solo exhibition at the Weatherspoon Art Museum in Greensboro, North Carolina, and will be included, upcoming, in a group show at the Herschel and Adler Modern in New York. She currently lives and works in Allentown, Pennsylvania, where she's a full professor at Moravian University. So welcome, Angela.
Thank you. That was a mouthful. You did great.
You've done a lot of stuff.
I'm old.
Yeah. That's what I say. Not about you, but about me.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's so great to be here, you guys. It's great to hear your voices.
Yeah.
Angela, so you're a little unique because we decided to assign you a movie because you were interested in the occult but weren't really sure what movie to pick, and maybe not like a movie person, which is totally fine. And so I'm so curious about what you thought about The Witches of Eastwick.
Oh yeah, it's so funny because I mean, the backstory here.
Was this the first time you saw it?
This is the first time I saw it. Shockingly. Okay. I just a little backstory about why I'm kind of like a movie loser, right? Yeah. I don't know. I think what was really refreshing about seeing this movie with 30-year older eyes, this movie came out in 87, I guess, was that there's now so much more language around all of the kind of contemporary feminist concerns that we just didn't have language for at the time. You know, everyday people didn't. At least young baby Angie did not know how to put a finger on what the heck I was seeing in these movies that was just not sitting right, right? So, I think like early on, like in my teenage years, I just was like, no, I'm done with movies. I am very susceptible to, like, I just get easily seduced by the moving image, by movies, emotional roller coaster, you know, like I am like deep in it and then looking through this lens in a really powerful way. And I just stopped trusting movies to like with that part of myself, if that makes sense. Like that's what I can.
It does.
That's
it
amazing does. Yeah. Because your paintings sort of hint at these narratives that feel like stills from a film. Mm-hmm. And the scale of your work is also sort of cinematic.
Yeah, yeah, no, I love that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I'm using the tropes that I understand are powerful, but hopefully to my own advantage, maybe, as opposed to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, so.
I get that. Yeah, get that because they're artists that I love, but I don't want to be so heavily influenced by them that I'll stop looking at them because I don't want to imitate what they're doing. I can understand what they're doing on a level, but I don't want to study it and recreate what they're doing.
Well, I just was going to say, like with movies, it's like, you know, as a young budding feminist, just seeing like, so, I mean, Hollywood is just so slow to catch up, right? Like Disney was so slow to catch up on like what it is they think will sell, what they think that people will like go see. And the masses maybe aren't as up to speed, you know, like in terms of normalizing certain gender roles or, you know, sexuality, et cetera, et cetera. Right. So, I guess that's why I just kind of gave up on movies a long time ago. But I do think I should probably revisit and come back around because it's like there are a lot of really good movies out there. I feel like after we decided this on this movie, I was like, oh, man, I should have said this one or this one or this one.
And now you said that you watched a few other kind of witchy movies to prepare for that podcast.
I was gonna and I didn't. I really wanted to see that movie, Thelma. That is supposed to be really good. I didn't.
I was looking into that. Yeah, that was. Have
is
you?
Is that something new? No.
I think it's 2017. Okay. So new, like new-ish. I would say like any movie 4 years. Yeah. I call new.
Same.
But yeah, it looks really good. I know Angela. You mentioned that you're not big on the gore kind of imagery, and I'm totally with you. And so it made it very difficult to pick a movie about witches that doesn't. And I, you know, I think that I, with The Witches of Eastwick, I don't actually know like what kind of movie it is. Yeah. Like it's, I don't know if it's a comedy. Yeah. I don't know if, I don't think it's a romance. I don't think it's a, weird. How would you classify Witches of Eastwick?
I'm not sure, but I was going to say is that I think we're kind of wrong talking about the Witches of Eastwick not being a gory movie because all three of those characters have to make love to Jack Nicholson. And I think that's one of the more appalling acts.
I have to say that I adore Jack Nicholson in movies where he's behaving badly. Like, I just love him when he's a mess. Like, especially, like, we'll get to it, but there's that scene where he's ironing and, like, he is just, like, over the top.
He is chewing up the scenery.
Like, he is. And I, like, I was thinking, like, The Shining and As Good As It Gets, and even, like, when he played the Joker, and I'm like, I just love a good, like, bad Jack Nicholson. There's, and that little bitty ponytail he has, it's just, like, it's the, like, the icing on the cake.
Yes.
But you know what? Hi, you're right in that it's kind of like a, for me, like, as an adult watching this, I kind of, it was kind of like a psychological thriller because it had hints of, like, kind of abusive relationship kind of stuff going on. And I was like, ugh, like, it's kind of hard to watch these women go through, you know, these sort of, like, very typical phases of, like, a shitty relationship. But before we get into that, because that stuff we can certainly talk about, but Angela, would you do us a favor and give us a brief summary of the movie for our listeners?
Oh, sure. I actually have the, from the, you know, the back of the VHS cassette. What would have gone on the VHS?
Excellent. Okay.
But, okay. Sure. So it says three small town friends, Alexandra, played by Cher, Jane, played by Susan Sarandon, and Suki, played by Michelle Pfeiffer, have each having lost the man of their lives, are feeling unfulfilled until a furtive stranger, Daryl Van Horn, played by Jack Nicholson, arrives and begins courting each of them in turn. Eventually, Daryl tells them that they are witches. I don't think he ever actually says they are witches, right? Like, he just kind of shows them.
I don't think so. Yeah.
But then as the three friends spend more time at his mansion enjoying themselves and learning about their powers, they begin to worry about Daryl's ultimate intentions. Which is weird. Like, I didn't actually, that's probably not how I would have summarized the movie. I would have summarized the movie like a full hour of three really incredibly powerful women being like underwritten for, who talk about nothing but men. Like, if this movie does not pass the Bechdel test until like the halfway mark, it's shocking.
Yeah. I love that you bring that up because it is centered around three female protagonists, and yet most of the time they talk about a man or men or, you know. And actually what I loved in there, the beginning when they sort of form like this little coven of like, you know,
like boozy slumber party
bonding. I loved that scene. It's so like 1980s. It's fabulous. But they're sort of acknowledging the fact that, you know, like, hey, why are we always talking about men? And it's like, yeah, why is that? But I can see that they're bonding, especially because there's that kind of, you know, asshole character. I don't know who that guy was. I think his name was Walter. But he was the guy that groped Susan Sarandon.
Oh, right, like the school principal.
I think he was her boss. Yeah, and then he was making that big speech, but they all, you know, really had pretty negative experiences with that dude.
Yes. And he was like the town lech.
I could see how that would like really...
Mm-hmm. Who was also in power, who was also on the pulpit. Extolling Christian values and judging other people's behavior while he'd already displayed that he's had really bad behavior and wouldn't even stop talking while the storm is threatening the health and safety of the children. It's like lightning's popping, things are getting pushed over, and he won't stop.
I mean, I was definitely getting like Trump kind of like vibes coming from that guy. It was just, I mean, now anytime we see Predator, I think I just think of Donald Trump, but you know, that's just me.
That's funny. I never thought about Predator versus Alien because it's really about the wall he wanted to build.
Yes. Oh my gosh, that's too good.
So I wanted to mention that the film is based on a book by John Updike, who also wrote like Hotel New Hampshire and World According to Garp. And a million other books. A really prolific author. Oh, and I was listening to the audiobook earlier this year. So.
And you said you didn't research this episode.
Well, it's funny. I kind of forgot about it because I'm old, and I forget about things. But yeah, it is. It's a very different. The book is a very different experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, the movie, I mean, I've not read the book, but I've heard that the book is a little bit darker, I think, in terms of content. So, I mean, the movie and all, it's, you know, it has some dark moments. I mean, we can get to, like, the cherry scene and all of that. But, like, generally, it feels, like, pretty light and airy. Like, it doesn't get too serious. Even when somebody dies, it's kind of like, you know, I mean, I guess we should do something about it, but well, Angela, I was gonna ask you, so obviously you have this interest in the occult and witches. Where do you think this is coming from? Like, what's drawing you to this particular type of subject?
Well,
matter?
You know, I mean, I'm interested in how meaning gets made, and that's, you know, what my main kind of driving question has been since the beginning of my, you know, art making life. And you know, I've been doing these things with museums where I'm kind of looking at their collection, I'm looking at art history, I'm looking at the ways in which women have been represented throughout time, and I'm constantly asking if it's possible to, like, without changing very much at all, literally reinsert a new narrative so that women have these heroes to look towards instead of kind of constantly looking at themselves through the lens of you know, a patriarchal society, right? So, I think, and I'm currently in conversation with a museum in Connecticut, and it happens to be located in the place where the first witch trials took place in America 30 years before Salem.
Oh, wow.
So this is like very early on.
Wow.
Yeah. So I found that kind of, got me interested, and but you know, I mean, it's like kind of an obvious, like, like subject or topic for me, right? Like it's one I've kind of avoided for a long time because I think the reputation that goes along with witch and gender is a little, it's so heavy-handed to a point, but I think it is worth looking at now. There is like a cultural shift. There's a real kind of like another resurgence. I feel like it's always been brewing in the background, right? Like people never really want to let go of witches. And then
brewing in the background. I love that.
I know. I like that.
There's a famous Margaret Atwood quote where she talks about like what a culture has to say about witchcraft, whether like just in a funny way or in earnest, has a lot to do with its views of women and sexuality and power.
Wow.
And I think, and like, especially about like the, you know, powers between the sexes. And so, I think it's an interesting, it's just like a super interesting thing. So I joined an online coven.
Oh my God.
That's excellent.
Isn't that crazy? Super exciting and really interesting. And I have a really good friend from like my childhood who is a full-on witch, you guys. Like, and so we're doing a little collaborating too. So I'm not sure what it's going to look like, but I'm definitely, at the end of the day though, what's really interesting is I think art is witchcraft. Like, just straight up like like combining correspondences, like finding like layers and ways of like like concocting and imagining and creating new veins of life
and getting visions.
Exactly. So it's like fun. It's cool.
I feel like you're really onto something there, Angela, because I was researching a little bit more about how we came to this stereotype of the witch. And I think a lot of it, from what I understand, comes from our experiences with the Black Death or the plague, because it was so, you know, like cataclysmic. I think like one in every three people died. Like, it's just so insane to me to think about that. But because it's so unexplainable, they really kind of scapegoated women in that case and sort of blamed women, their sort of like sorcery and whatnot, and kind of caused like this like evil panic in communities. And but I was thinking like maybe the pandemic now is also causing some resurgence and some of these fearful things, you know, fearful ideas of women and healers, and I don't know, like, I do feel like there's a lot of people talking about it, and writing about it, and making art about it. It is really fascinating.
Yeah, I was thinking about it. I think, like, right after Trump was elected, speaking of male figures that you want to go away.
Yes.
I think that there was a huge reset, because you just feel so powerless, and you feel like literally our rights are being taken away from us as we speak.
Oh my God, yeah.
Like bodily autonomy, agency of all kinds. And so, you know, there was, I think there was a huge kind of wave of both kind of literal witchcraft kind of emerging, but also like just women, like everyday women wanting like to cling to something. Yeah,
The idea of a rebellious woman,
Well, I'm curious to know what you thought of Cher's character, because she is an artist in this movie. And
she's so funny.
If you could describe Cher's character, whose name is Alex in the movie, and what kind of work she does.
she makes these like, you know, what we would once considered to be these fertility goddess like forms, right? Like a Venus of Willendorf kind of character, and she makes them over and over again by hand, even though they look exactly the same. Or are they plaster cast? I can't tell. I thought it was hilarious because it's like, yes, if Satan were to come here and offer you anything to make you want to work with him, it would be a New York gallery show, right? Like, it would be like, it'd be like Gagosian or David Zwirner.
This isn't as hypothetical as you think.
You know what? I'll say it. I'd have sex with Jack Nicholson for a show at David's Warner. I'm not embarrassed. I would do it.
I'd rather have sex with David Swartz.
This is true. This is true.
Are you listening, David?
Now, okay, I know. We'll have to tag him in. So,
oh God, please don't.
But I loved, course, this is so typical, but Jack Nicholson or his, you know, character, Daryl Van Horn, you know, it's not so subtle, gives Alex advice in the studio. And hi, do you remember what advice?
He said, go bigger.
Go bigger.
Which is like grad school, right?
Yeah.
Isn't that the canned advice of a lame professor?
Yeah, I think so.
Just
Angela,
bigger.
What's your experience with scale and advice with that?
Well, I actually think it's interesting for female artists to go bigger, but yeah, it's totally, you're so right. It's like, yeah, like that's the, like, if you don't know what it is, just make it bigger. Yeah, bigger is better. That was...
You see her in the movie at one point, you glimpse at her making a bigger sculpture. So
yeah.
she was doing it. She was very inspired. Yes. Yeah. Right.
Like enormous. And so while we're talking about scale, do you remember the conversation that they have about penis size?
Oh,
and
yes.
The three women have different preferences?
I appreciated that scene simply because, A, I appreciate small works of art, number one. But also, like, I just feel like it's a great opportunity to say that women are different. Some like big, some like small. And,
yeah.
Because I think men get these, like, crazy inferiority complexes about their penis. And it's like, you can, anybody, there are so many people on the planet, somebody's going to like it, you know? So
yeah,
I liked that. I thought that was really kind of, but it's such a, you know, it's like, it's so cliche girl talk. Like, do we really talk about men's penises? Not really. I mean,
that's like such a violation against the Brechtel test, right?
It totally is.
That, like, not only are you talking about men, but you're talking about penises.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I did like the fact that they were, like, drinking booze and, like, snacking on junk food. I just, like, these beautiful women are, like, eating Cheese Whiz and, you know, it's like... Okay, I can appreciate that, you know, they're not eating salads and, you know, something like that. Like, they're...
on Peloton bikes while they're eating salads.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That scene really reminds me of that John Curran painting. Remember those series he
did?
Yes.
The Suburban Housewives.
Yes.
Like, drinking martinis in the middle of the day. And, yeah.
Yes. Those, I do love those quite a bit. I mean, they're not as racy as some of his other ones, but I think they're hilarious, you know? I just, and I tend to sort of roll my eyes at suburbia and the sort of Stepford Wife cliche. And so I kind of like, you know, I like that a lot.
Yeah.
But to you, Angela, did you have a scene that maybe, like, do you think, was there anything that you could draw from in as a painter in terms of, like, the visuals?
The cherry vomiting? I don't know. I thought Veronica, she was the equal to Jack Nicholson's performance, right?
Like the one that dies. Cartwright,
is that her name?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The woman who played Felicia. Yes. Oh my gosh.
Right?
She was amazing. Like, I thought she was fantastic.
Bugging out and ranting and, like, yeah. And I've been in that situation before, not exactly with Satan showing up to town, but with, like, there's some clear and present danger that no one wants to acknowledge. Well, kind of like COVID. And you're like, you bitches need to put your masks on. You need to stay home, you know? So she was the one saying, like, this guy's really a threat.
Yeah.
It's too bad she was a religious zealot.
I know.
But
yeah.
Otherwise, I could identify with her.
She totally saw it coming, but... And I don't know exactly... Like, I always was thinking, like, maybe she had some witchiness, too, because she could foresee... Because
she saw it.
It's like, how did she know? Unless...
It takes one to know one.
Kinda. I mean, unless Jack Nicholson had, you know, put a spell on her or... something, but yeah, she and I just rewatched that scene today where she's vomiting up the cherries and like she's so like vexed, like she's just talking about sex and like, oh my God, like it's just such a great performance.
Yeah. But it happens as a result of her falling down the stairs, and her falling down the stairs was a spell.
Yeah.
Didn't Jack Nicholson will her to fall down the stairs?
Yes, I think so.
Think that, and then the
Oh,
sorry. And then the nurses explain her sort of like her agitated state as being that like bone marrow seeped into her bloodstream, and that often makes people act more aggressive.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Which could have been true, but like that doesn't explain her vomiting like cherry pits and goo.
Right, right. You know?
That was so Exorcist. I don't know, Angela, if you have seen The Exorcist.
It'll rattle you.
I have not. No.
Yeah.
I've seen clips of it and plenty of parodies of it, right?
So yeah. You probably know it just from like popular culture, but you know, there's the scene again where you've got like the green vomit, and it's a hard scene to watch, and the cherries are just as awful, like you know, it's so repulsive, but I love it. You know,
it's sort of played a little like a comedy, though.
It is.
Like, The Exorcist is still terrifying after 45 years.
Oh, yeah.
It's still the scariest thing you'll ever see.
So back, I think in the early 2000s when I was in college, I got a new phone, and it was the first phone I could like put like a fancy ringtone on. So I was like, ooh. And so I don't know what compelled me, but I put
the power of Christ compelled me,
but it was around Halloween. So I put The Exorcist ringtone, the tubular bells or whatever it's called.
Yeah.
And I could only last about a week because it freaked me the fuck out. Like every time. Like, why did I do that? That's such a scary rhythm. You know, anyway, so don't do that, listeners. That's very scary. So another scene that really I hadn't seen this in decades, so it's a really fun thing to watch as an adult. But the other scene that really stood out to me was the one where Susan Sarandon is being like slut shamed at the grocery store. Oh my gosh! I don't know what
she's finally feeling herself. You know, she's like this little mousy music teacher, and then she gets sexed up by Jack Nicholson, and then she's in the grocery store and she's got a Brazilian blowout and she's eating pickles out of the jar while she's still shopping, and she's like giving advice about chocolate.
Yeah, she's also not wearing a bra, which I think that all women pandemic can relate to, because I did not wear a bra for like a whole year and it was marvelous. So I was like, yeah, let him hang out, Susan Sarandon. Yeah. Like, you got a nice pair. But I felt so bad for her because she was slut-shamed. And I just thought, I just reminded me of how women can also, you know, engage in misogyny. And
absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Oh my gosh.
You know, and it's so, I mean, actually, I think that for the most part, besides, you know, the devil, the women in this movie were pretty much harassed by women. And so it's like, oh man, you know, that
it's true.
Yeah.
Wow. That's so interesting. Oh, woman on woman violence.
Yeah, I totally was.
What's interesting, like the witch trials, many of the people who accused women of being witches were other
women. So interesting. So if a woman wants to be heard, she needs to cause trouble for another woman.
Yeah, I think that's something you see that is really common with sort of like hierarchies, where the whoever's on top will pit the others against each other.
Uh-huh.
And it's it's just a way to maintain, you know, their status.
Look, have any of you watched the series Mrs. America about Phyllis Schlafly?
Phyllis Schlafly, oh my God.
Schlafly, right. Yes. And she went after the women's movement.
She did.
Like she demonized them and tried to destroy them.
I started that one. I think it's I found it really, I don't know why I didn't finish watching it, but I think Phyllis Schlafly is just such a, she's complicated.
Yes.
I vomit a little bit in my mouth when I think of her. Yeah. So I'm just like, ugh, you know, and maybe yeah. because I like the actress Kate Blanchett so much, and she really
yeah, she's wonderful.
Took that character to heart. Oh,
you know, I mean, this brings me back to one of my favorite subjects is about how the only people that get really upset about queerness are closeted homosexuals.
Oh, okay.
So it's like, how dare you have confidence and liberation? Mm-hmm. You, it's like the crabs crawling out of the bucket, you know? It's like, no, you've got to stay oppressed. Mm-hmm. You've got to, you know, if, you know, who do you think you are? Mm-hmm. Get back down here in this misery.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that the women of Eastwick mm-hmm. kind of see the three... the three witches, which again, they're not even called witches in the movie, but as threats to their like status quo, their comfortable suburban lives. And it's like, they've uh-huh. opened this like vision of possibilities, you know? And it's like, you don't have to just be this like Christian who always does the right thing and, you know, has to be like the perfect image of domesticity. But of course it all goes horribly wrong, you know? Yeah. And so, but you know, before we get to that, one of my favorite parts of this movie is the pink balloon scene or shot.
Uh-huh.
I just uh-huh. love, I mean, do you remember this, Angela, where you have all these pink balloons and they're surrounding the women?
It's kind of like the honeymoon phase yeah. where the oh kids God, are there. Totally. It's the extended family. Everybody's just... like they're using like a trolley like a food trolley yes. as a prop where they're like spinning around and
it's so yeah. over the top, but it's like, oh my God, like that's
euphoria.
Yeah,
it's new romance
yeah. And you know, I mean, I guess at this point they're okay with being his, I mean, it's he's basically forming like a, oh, what do you call it when you have like multiple wives? What is that called?
Polygamy?
Yeah. And because it seems
Mormonism.
Like, yeah. It seems like at first they're a bit jealous of one another, and then they kind of accept it that they're
that's
both,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
Which I think is a really shitty thing for the devil or Jack Nicholson to do, to like seduce these three best friends and like pit them against yeah. one another. It's like, oh, yeah. like, of course they're giving each other the,
yeah.
you know.
Come on, Satan, stop being mean.
I know. But it's almost like he's playing this sort of like chess game strategy in order
totally.
To. Totally. Gosh. Okay. So.
Which makes him more man yes. than God.
Yeah.
I can't tell. Is this like a satire or is it just like a kind of completely unaware male fantasy being like leveled yeah. against these female characters, or like even when mm-hmm. the women are kind of finding their power, you know, like Susan Sarandon's scene, for instance, like the mansplaining is off the charts. Like he's explaining how and it's kind of couched in this idea of like maybe yeah. he understands
right.
them in a way that nobody else does, but it also just feels like this kind of like explanatory, like I'm gonna tell you how to feel. And that's why she,
yeah.
I think, feels betrayed by the other women, because, like, I don't know.
Yeah.
They don't get to find their
mm-hmm.
own power. That's the part
yeah.
that's really unsettling about this. Like, I think in the novel, I haven't read the book, but I did read a summary of it, and it suggested that the women already have, like,
mm-hmm.
they've been toying
uh-huh.
with the idea of witchcraft
yeah.
before Nicholson even,
right.
or Satan character even
yeah,
shows up.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem like it requires Jack Nicholson to coax their powers, you know, when actually they were kind of figuring it out before him.
Right.
Well,
yeah.
Suki was, right? Like that, you
yeah.
know, she's like, isn't it weird that, you know, and then the rain, the storm, like that's a definite
uh-huh.
witch
they can
trope,
alter the
right?
weather,
like,
yes.
Or they live in Texas and it's perfectly
yeah.
normal to have, like we will actually go from like 80 degrees
right.
to like 20 degrees within 70, like 48 hours or something. Like, wild. You're like, wow.
Yeah.
But they're not, they're in like a New Hampshire kind of, you know, northeast. idyllic, you know, small town, which I think at the opening credits, it sort of suggests that the town has existed for several centuries, which makes you think that maybe there were some origins of like witch trials and, you know, that kind of thing happening.
Yeah, well, they hint that the mansion that Jack Nicholson buys
is the
site of some witch lore.
Something going on. Oh my God. Uh-huh. Like, I loved the decor was totally tacky, but I loved it. and I think Cher's character kind of points that out. It's like, you have no taste, and it's like, no, but it's like it's art, it's bad, and it's hilarious. Uh-huh. And I loved the house. I thought it was a really great backdrop for all of this craziness. I was really feeling the scene where Susan Sarandon is seduced by Jack Nicholson. Angela, do you remember that scene with the violin playing and the piano? Oh my God. There's that.
And she cuts her finger. Yeah.
Yeah, she cuts her finger. There's that moment, oh my God, where he like parts her legs. And then you're like, oh my God, oh my God. Like, what is he doing? And then he places her cello, you know, and it's just like, wow. So yeah. I have some experiences with this because I am currently dating a musician.
You may want to put your children to bed right now.
Yes, sorry, dear listeners. This will be shocking. But music is sexy, though. It's very seductive.
Vibration.
Yeah, the vibration. So my boyfriend plays clarinet, but I love it. I love that he plays clarinet. In fact, that's one of the things that drew me to him was the clarinet. And so on our first date, I am such a slut, y'all. Like, I'm so bluesy.
Stop slut shaming yourself.
I know, but I'll own this one. But sometimes
you're an adult woman.
Yes, I'm an adult woman, and I have, you know, I can be playful. When we were first texting and we were figuring out our first date, I was inviting him to come see my studio because he was curious about the work that I was doing. And I said, yeah, and then you'll have to bring your clarinet, wink, wink, like a little, like, you know, like sexual innuendo. And he showed up with his clarinet. And I was like, oh my God, that is so cute. And so he shows me how to play it, which I was like, okay. But then there's all these like very sexy.
I'm struggling not to make jokes right now.
So many innuendos.
Some low-hanging fruit up in here.
Totally. So with the clarinet, this will shock you, but with the clarinet, there are these terms like fingering and blowing and tonguing, and I'm just like, oh my God, like I totally fell hook, line, and sinker.
How are you going to get teenagers to play the clarinet if you don't have adjectives like that for what it is?
All in the name of education.
Totally, totally. I still don't know how to play the clarinet, but I fell in love. That music, you know, that sort of, I mean, it's so over the top. I mean, what was it? They were like the violin caught on fire, you know, at the end.
And
it was
just yes, like, oh, it's smoking and it burst into flames. Yeah.
Which is so appropriate for that movie.
That was a metaphor for her nether regions.
Yes, yes. I think I felt really connected to Susan Sarandon because she had transformed the most. And she had really connected to her sexuality and her power. And she didn't really want to let it go when her two other witchy sisters were kind of like, you know, I'm getting some red flags. You know, from Daryl Van Horn, you know, so.
Yeah.
So anyway, so I'm sorry, Ben, if you're listening, if I embarrassed you on this podcast, but I love you. I love your clarinet.
If they've made it this far, I think that they can handle your,
totally,
your first date story.
Angela, was there anything else you wanted to dive into that stood out to you?
Let's see. I don't know. The other idea about, like, Suki's character is completely unbelievable. Yeah. Like, how does she have six children and a full-time job? They're, like, all the same age or something?
Yeah, they do look. I can't
tell if they're, like,
She had a litter of puppies.
And Angela, you're a mother, so you would know a little bit about time management and being a professional woman and artist. You know, I'm sure that's not easy.
Do you get the devil to help you, Angela?
Yeah, it's hard spending all that time in the mansion when you have to,
How old are your kids?
9 and 4.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
Are they helping you in your studio? Or?
Oh, you're so cute. I love... No.
If you were a farmer, that's why farmers have kids.
Yeah. I mean, I sometimes post on social media, like, my daughter, you know, applying gesso or something like that to a canvas. But it lasts for, like, literally 2 minutes. Her attention span for those kinds of tedious activities are about as long as mine, you know. It's not like super fun work, you know, they're constantly around. They have, like, they've taken over the studio. They have, like, their toys and stuff here. So during the pandemic, it was, like, all hands on deck and just trying to, like, slice out, like, you know, an hour of focused attention. Like, that's the hardest part about being a parent, is you think that your kid's just gonna, like, hang out in a corner do one thing.
That's not, like, how it works. I don't remember.
No. All, like, just childcare. Like, that's all. You just need to have someone to take care of them for at least, like, 6 hours a day. Like, done. That's it. That's the answer.
That makes me want to talk to my dad, because I have a lot of, well, not a lot, but I have some memories of hanging out with him in his studio, and he would give us sticks to kind of paint on and, you know, things like that. And I remember just thinking it was so badass that he was doing these, like, works of art and these sculptures. And I have really fond memories of that, but I'm wondering what it was actually like. You know, like, were we irritating and he was trying to get something done or had a deadline?
Yeah, probably that.
And it's like, oh my God, here are some sticks. Like, fucking make him a snake and, like, leave me alone. So I don't know, but I thought it was really magical. You know.
Oh, I love that. I love hearing that, because it probably was really different from his point of view, but the idea that you walk away with this, like, amazing memory. Like,
I had a great time painting sticks and stuff and, you know, just kind of looking at them and wishing that I had those skills and the confidence to make marks, because it's not an easy thing to do, you know. So it was inspiring as a kid. So, you know, I mean... I'm not a parent, but, you know, I could, plus, you know, I'm kind of thinking, like, Angela, you could probably get some studio assistants out of that, right? Like, you could train them early and maybe they'll help you out.
Maybe. I mean, there is a long lineage, right? There's, like, a Kiki Smith was a Tony Smith.
Yeah. Oh, like, yeah.
Speaking of witches.
Right? Oh, yeah, totally. Right? Totally.
Well, you know, this makes me think about having unpaid interns, too.
Oh, I know.
Where you spend hours explaining something that would, take you 10 minutes to do. I can imagine children are exponentially, like, more difficult to utilize.
Plus, you're the parent, right? So they, like, don't think that you have any skills. It's like hearing celebrities talk about their kids and whether their kids are, they're like... I think it was, like, Kristen, what's her face, who was the voice of Elsa or whatever. Or Anna. She was talking, she has kids, and she was like, our kids just, like, they don't even care. Like, they just, like, they don't appreciate your, like, what other people admire in you, your kids do not. They do not care.
Yeah.
At the end of the day.
There are those really funny interviews of, you know, an actor who's playing, like, a superhero, like Superman, and then they ask their kids, like, what's your favorite superhero movie? And their kids are like, I like Batman. I like that other dude. You know, it's like, oh my God, your dad is Superman, but you're more into that other thing. But I could kind of, you know, kids are, you know, they're just going to say, the beauty about being a child is that you can say whatever the fuck you want and nobody passes judgment and people often think it's hilarious.
Well, Angela, I'm also realizing that we could have talked about Frozen today, because that's a movie I've never seen and you're well versed in.
Oh, I actually have never seen.
You've never seen it?
No. Isn't it kind of witchy, though?
Like, listen.
There's some magic.
The other thing, there definitely is, and it's a great story. I've read about it. But it's one of those things, like, when you have kids, you don't want to sit and watch the thing with them. That has bought you 45 minutes or an hour or whatever to go do something else.
That's the heroine.
I have seen that movie, and you don't need to watch it.
It's a good story, though, right? It's about sisterly love instead of, you know, the prince
saving. I totally love that. You know, I guess I really I'm so stuck in, like, the Renaissance, the Disney Renaissance, and it's really hard for me to, like, embrace the new stuff. And I'm totally, this is my age, and I'm just, it's okay. I'm okay with it. But yeah, I just could not. I watched it in the theater, and my mom wanted to go see it, and I was like, I actually laughed during most of it. Like, I just thought it was so dumb. But I do appreciate that Disney tries to, like.
Look at you heckling a kid's movie.
I told it was. My sister and I both were, like, laughing hysterically at this movie because we thought it was so bad. But then everybody loved it. We were like, what are we, the dumb dumbs in the room who just don't get it? But. It wasn't my favorite, but again, I'm coming from, like, the horrible tropey, like, sexist movies from the 80s and the 90s, so, you know, I mean, that's what I grew up with, and
that's what you love.
That's what I love. I know. Call me Phyllis Schlafly, whatever. Please don't do that. Speaking of toxic individuals, so the stages of a relationship with a narcissist really stuck out to me in this movie. Sure. Hyde, I think you know who I'm talking about.
Voldemort.
And so I don't know if you two are kind of familiar, maybe a little bit, with, like, some of those phases, but they almost mirror what happens in this movie with Jack Nicholson, and the way that he, like, first he love bombs, right? So he's just like, I'm gonna, like when he goes to see Susan Sarandon perform, he, like, claps in, like, a ridiculous way where it's just, like, over the
exactly.
top.
Exactly.
And then.
But he's also sleeping during the performance.
I know. I'm like, what? Who are you? And then with Cher, he buys up all of her sculptures and he's.
Yes.
And then he also, like, gives her this, like, I'm a feminist speech. And you're like, fuck, you're not a feminist. You know, he's just pandering. Because
he's all things to all women.
Yeah, because he says all these things like, oh, you know, women are powerful and they create their creators, and, you know, he's sort of in awe of the fertility and all of that. And it's like, I could totally see, you know, he's just trying to seduce, right? But anyway, so there's the love bombing, and then the second phase of a narcissistic relationship is isolation, which is when they basically tell you that, like, in my experience, it was kind of like, well, you know, you hang out with your friends too much, or you seem to be too tied to your family, like, you should be more independent. But what they're trying to do is get you to like not talk to anybody, so that folks
separate you from your support system.
Yeah, and then I think sometimes some of that is about not wanting, like, basically they can't seduce everybody in your life, and so other folks recognize the red flags, and they don't want anybody else to be able to point that out to you. Like, if Cher or Michelle or Susan, you know, we're going to their other friends, and they're like, hey, we met this really great guy, and they're like, he sounds a little sketch, I don't know. So there's isolation. And then the third phase is the sort of wrath phase, or discarding, and which was pretty terrible, because in the movie he took, you know, their greatest fear and turn it into their reality.
Right.
Like, ugh, like, totally. Like, they will, like, treat you like shit, you know, if you, even give a little inkling that you're not sure about the relationship, or maybe you want a little bit more or whatever. And then, of course, then there's the kind of makeup period where they, it kind of cycles back to love bombing almost. And so anyway, so I was just like, oh my gosh, like he's such a narcissist and they're all in that relationship. Yeah. But I'm so glad that they were able to break away from it, because most of the time it's really hard to free yourself, you know.
Well, and I think that the three of them together were able to do it more effectively.
Totally, totally.
So is this a poster for polygamy then? Is that like, because if you have three people in a narcissistic relationship?
You can't trust a man unless you got some sister wives.
You know what? I think that there's probably some truth. Like, I'm thinking about my own experiences, and it's like, yeah, if I had had a buddy in there, I think it probably would have been easier.
Well, it's like unionizing, you know? Right. Like, it's not just me. Mm-hmm. We will leave, and we will take all the pussy with us.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, yeah, the gaslighting thing. I, you know, what's interesting is I noted that was the...
Yeah, you have a witness.
The time, the one time where they start to talk about something other than men is during this, where they start revealing their greatest fears. And then, so then that comes completely, like, they, he turns that against them. Like, it's the one time they like, you know, break the Bechdel test, and then... And then it comes crashing down.
And that's interesting.
Yeah, that's
like such a sociopath move, because, you know, it's always so thrilling when somebody wants to get to know you and they're showing an interest in you. But he's doing it with the motive that I'm going to, this is ammunition to use when you disobey me.
Yeah, he had a plan. That's pretty clear. And I think the overall plan was to impregnate them. Like, is that what the seduction was about?
Right. He was trying to spawn.
What?
And he did.
Angela, what, how did you feel about all three women having Jack Nicholson's devil baby? What did you think about that? As a mother yourself.
So. It feels like a leading question, Erin.
Oh no. Well, I just I think that it's like very, like, obviously this movie was made in 87, and I'm just wondering, like, as our modern eyes, like, how do we feel about that? Because that's basically how the movie ends almost. I mean, obviously we can talk about the spell they cast against Jack Nicholson, but yeah, they end up having the babies. What do you think about that
one? Yeah. Did they not have access to abortion? Like, that seems like a pretty...
I know.
Like, yes, you, if you're going to abort anyone, like, it seems like a pretty clear, the devil. Obvious...
I would have thought...
Maybe Satan would be.
Yeah, it's like, dude, like, and obviously, you know, that... Oh, my God. Like, yeah, why would you have Satan's baby? And Susan Sarandon's character is kind of excusable only because she thought she couldn't and she wanted children.
Yeah.
But like Sookie or Michelle Pfeiffer, like, dude, you got like six or seven, like, I don't know.
Well, maybe Sookie doesn't believe in, you know, reproductive rights.
Yeah, that's true. She has six children. She has so many. All at the same time, evidently. So, yeah.
So, Erin, I'm wondering if we can patch in calls from Ivanka Trump, Marla Maples, and what's her name? Our first lady.
Melania.
Because they, I mean, we can just ask them directly, why would you have Satan's babies?
Yeah.
Oh, those poor kids.
Yeah. And it's like, and the fact that they were all boys, it's like, oh, barf, you know. I'm like, all right.
Yeah,
so.
And then they basically just get reduced to housewives in the end.
I know. Like,
that's the,
Yeah.
That's the end result. They're like all hanging out in the mansion and taking care of his
babies. Very interesting. I was wondering if they were trying to set up a sequel with that.
I think so I watched an interview with Cher, Susan Sarandon, and Michelle Pfeiffer, and they were talking about the movie, but also like who would play their characters in like Broadway or TV, or there was, you know, they were kind of like already thinking about it. But I think that there's going to be a new movie, new The Witches of Eastwick.
No way.
Soon. Yeah, like I think in 2022, I think is when it's slated.
Yeah, is this, it looks like a female figure or female director.
Yes, it is. Yeah, so maybe there'll be a better interpretation of, you know, the story. You know what would be kind of cool is if they just brought back the same characters, the same actors.
Oh, yes. Oh my God, that'd be amazing. And actually give them some characters.
Yes,
to play,
yes. Like. Uh-huh. Totally, because.
Oh my God, and the children, the three boys are adults now. Could be
See, we've already got this figured out.
We already got, yeah.
So, on one hand, I can appreciate the aesthetics of the actors, Cher, Michelle Pfeiffer, and Susan Sarandon, because they are absolutely beautiful in this movie.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
They are so, that one scene where they're all on the bed together, oh my God, you're just like, all right, it's just like a Victoria's Secret shoot from the 1980s. Like, it is so funny, but they're so pretty. And I just, but then you've got the other, you know, witchy trope, which is like the old hag. And I wonder if there's room for something in the middle, like still beautiful, but like an older woman who's still powerful and who still could represent fertility. But
now, Erin, do you want people to see this movie?
I know.
Or
see,
do you want
and with like the Sex and the City reboot, it's been kind of panned. And I just, it's like, I like that, like, you bring back these characters that have aged and they have wrinkles and gray hair, but then you make them such sloppy women. It's like, God damn it. You know, like, they could have been powerful. Yeah. They could have had, like, they could have just gotten better. Instead, they just got worse. And it's just like, I just want to see, as a woman who's also aging, I want to see more examples of powerful women who...
That makes sense. Yeah.
Because I feel like that just doesn't happen in Hollywood as much.
Mm-hmm. Well, not only are the actresses not aging well, perhaps, but the story of Sex and the City is not aging well. I mean, it's just so capitalist, so consumery.
But you know, Hyde, I feel like that is totally a product of the times of like late 90s, early 2000s. And I feel like we can say like, yes, there was lots of problems, but they also were onto some other things that were a bit progressive, and we can applaud that.
Yeah.
But then to just like, because I was a big Sex and the City fan, and I did I think the movies were absolutely garbage. In fact, I kind of think like the last season was kind of garbage, but as most of them are, I guess. But you know, I think that they could do something with you know, the Witches of Eastwick, bring back these amazing, still, they're still, I mean, I don't know about Cher. What's Cher up to lately? Is she still?
Yeah, she's.
She's still, I worry about Cher because.
She's ageless.
She's, like she hasn't, she's gotten so much plastic surgery and it's just like, I guess, you know, that's okay. But I love, like Michelle Pfeiffer, I think, you know, maybe she's gotten some plastic surgery. Susan Sarandon is a gem. Like, she holds her own. She's such a wonderful actor. And she looks her age, and I just really appreciate that.
Yeah.
Now, Angela, you work with figures in your paintings, and your figures tend to be like women. Are you drawn to a particular type of figure, or like, what are you looking for when you're composing a painting?
Well, it's changed over the years. I think it's been representative of where I've been personally. But now, because I'm working with these institutions, like the last exhibition I did with a Weatherspoon, I was looking specifically at the Coen sisters and their legacy. The Coen sisters are fantastic. I don't know if, you know, if anyone here knows about them.
There's a collection in Baltimore that was their personal collection, right?
Right, yes. And so they can, they have roots in North Carolina. That's where their brothers earned the fortune. It was like a textile industry, and then they and so they had family there, and they donated a number of works on paper to this what was at the time a women's college, and then became had an art gallery, and then became a museum, and the University of North Carolina, which is a big school. So But anyway, that was no small thing because it was a teaching institution. You know, being able to see works of art was not, we had no internet in the early 1900s.
Yeah.
Right.
So,
yeah.
Like, unless you went to Europe, you didn't get to see a Picasso. So they had a lot of these prints and Matisse, Picasso, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, I, you know, kind of dig into this, the stories and the narratives of, you know, those women, but also the art they were collecting, like Matisse and Picasso, the women represented in those images, thinking through the legacy of Orientalism, thinking through, you know, Etta, one of the sisters are thought to be in a relationship with Gertrude Stein. So there was a lot to kind of unpack and play with and think about. And so the characters I chose of them for my paintings for that, for instance, were chosen as a nod to Orientalist painting, but they were figures that had agency. As we know, the Orientalist like trope is something that was completely fictitious and an apology for colonization and you know, so on and so forth. So it was just a way of othering, but it was also a way of escaping because it was during two world wars, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, so I wanted to kind of play with the kind of complicated history of those female bodies and how they're represented and how they were being collected by women. So I don't know how to, like, I mean, that's not a simple answer. But I am oftentimes thinking about these invisible histories or dormant narratives surrounding women and trying to choose imagery that represents a more complicated kind of opening up of female characters.
Not just a woman as an art object, but a woman as a character.
Right, like something that might kind of, I mean, not without that. I am as easily seduced and intrigued by flesh as the next human being, probably. But but I think that there's something about just inserting a kind of humanization that isn't often, I hope I complicate the imagery is what I hope I do at the end of the day, you know?
Yeah.
So, and I don't mind them all sitting together in this kind of complicated, tense stew. But I do try to like centralize marginalized figures also. So for like an exhibition I did at the Delaware Art Museum, for instance, I, you know, chose to kind of move into the center, older women, or women of color, you know, kind of thinking about like how to literally put them in the center of the story.
Yeah.
Compositionally. Yeah. And, you know, so yeah, that's kind of how I think through it.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, if The Witches of Eastwick does get remade, I would think that we would just have a bit more diversity, you know, not just all like three beautiful white women, who have different hair colors, but like there's still this kind of the same, you know, kind of you know, stereotype.
No, it's just one of each. It's a buffet. It's like Neapolitan ice cream, you know. It's like you can't choose which flavor.
Neapolitan,
so.
Right.
I do love their hair so much. Like all of them have amazing hair in this movie.
Yeah,
you know, it's just so over the top. It's huge, and I just so good. But yeah, I think that that's interesting because like Hyde, you're a figurative artist, and so you probably also had, you know, to confront like incorporating a diverse figure or diverse groups of people.
Well, yeah. And I, and you know, Angela, I'm not sure who you're drawing from, if you hire models or if you sort of cast people or if you're painting from paintings. I'm generally painting my friends. So, and I, you know, have a spattering of, you know, age groups and genders and races and so yeah, and I think representation is important. I think, you know what, some I'll just say for a second, we don't have to talk about this very long, but because I am a gay sometimes people like forget that I paint women too, and I'll hear somebody go like, oh, introduce me, and they'll go like, oh, he paints these lovely men.
Oh,
and I'm like, open your eyes.
Yeah.
Like I really make not like I don't, it's not labored my choices to paint women as well, but it's like, I think it's interesting that they don't see that I paint women. oddly.
I wonder, Angela, if you get also kind of typecast as like, oh, you paint beautiful women in your paintings when you do, you know, have images of different types of people. But you know, I mean, but it's hard not to be seduced by the female form. Like I remember in figure drawing classes, mm-hmm. I always preferred either A, to draw a woman, or B, to draw a very, very large man, because they were more fun. You know, the curves and everything would kind of fill up a page a little bit better.
And you're kind of a lesbian.
And I'm kind of, yes, this is true. This is true.
I'm teasing.
Well, but that's interesting, Hyde, because, you know, I just saw your show at Conduit today, and all sorts of types.
Thank you.
Also, I mean, beautiful, beautiful show. Listeners, if you haven't seen it, you probably won't, because this will come out after.
it closes after Friday.
So you missed it. But, you know, you have all different types of people, and, you know, it's really great to see, you know, some diversity in figures. One of my funniest memories is when we did a show and you had drawings or paintings of me on the wall.
Yeah.
And then somebody wrote in the book and they were saying something like, oh, I love, you know, the different types of bodies. You've got women with big boobs and women with small boobs or no boobs. And I was like, I'm the no boobs girl of the comic. I know that. But
yeah, I love that too, that they reduce diversity to breast size.
To just the boob size.
Yeah. Okay. But yeah, I think that, you know, it's important to have different, you know, types of figures and also, Angela, you seem to be drawn to animals. And Hyde, I know you've been playing around with some animal imagery as well.
In my art.
His personal life is a different story.
I've been accused of many things.
What was the reason? What's going on with the animals? Like, why are you drawn to depicting animals in your work?
Well, I think at that point I was thinking about paintings as a kind of stand-in for an emotional range, like a personal emotional range. Like, I think the way that we process and the way that we kind of derive from archetypes or mythology to kind of learn about our own psychology, like it's kind of Jungian in that way, right? Like I was kind of thinking, but also, like, you know, things like rabbit, it's like fertility, abundance.
Yes.
I'm vegetarian, so like painting a dead rabbit is not necessarily like a symbol of abundance for me, but it is like it's in the ethos. It's like in the like grand consciousness as such.
And yes.
I was also thinking about like female heroes' journeys. That's not something that's ever really been, like, there's a new book that just came out, thank God. But like 7 years ago when I was making that work, there wasn't that kind of, and I was thinking about fairy tales and like, are there any stories that have female protagonists as the lead that could be, you know, kind of listed as a hero's journey? And usually it's in fairy tales, right? Or like Alice in Wonderland, and, you know, the rabbit features prominently in that. And so, you know, it's a magical creature, you know, it's, I just love animals too, though. Like, just painting them from like a painterly point of view, it's like just like, you know, the texture. They're just beautiful.
They can be symbolic and potent, and then they can also represent our kind of basic human needs. And like, I really enjoy seeing some of the animals that pop up in some of your work. I just think you've got such a really great diverse like range of representation. But I'll never forget that painting that you had, that I curated in with it had like a wolf in it, it was insane. Like this, like, it was so violent, but it was so beautiful, you know?
What one was that? Maybe it was a boar hunt or something.
Oh, that's what it was. Oh, it was so cool. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I mean, it was just like, whoa. So there's an intensity there, you know? And I think that like, it's kind of spooky. You know, like the ways that like you can coax out, you know, our like primal, like, you know, urges and
You're making me think about there's this Robert Hughes book called American Visions about American art history. Are you familiar with it?
No.
It's an easy read. It's really interesting perspective because he was Australian. Because I've always, like, before the 20th century, I'm not interested in art, American art.
Oh,
you know, but But it contextualized it and kind of explained why some of it was awkward or not interesting to me. But one of the things was when they sent explorers to the continent from Europe, and they sent back these epic paintings that were sort of like cinema, because there were these grand landscapes with this magical golden light, and they were on a scale that was panoramic. And I don't know if you've ever seen any of those paintings, but I'm thinking that the Museum of Western Heritage in Oklahoma City has quite a few of them, but they're just like, they're scaled like your paintings, Angela. Sorry, I brought this up because I felt like you guys were talking about something with this boar hunt, and I was thinking about like this kind of, oh, maybe giving people that cathartic experience where you can get lost in a painting, and why, like, how that it can still be effective even with television, even with cinema, even with pocket devices. You can still have that experience in a with a painting.
Yeah, I think it's magical. I think paint is magical. Like, I hope
that I do too. I do too.
Get seduced by
totally.
Yeah.
I do have one little tidbit. I know on our last episode I shared some of my egg knowledge. and I found out that a primitive type of glass ball, and I know this was used in America, I don't know about in Europe, but an egg would be cracked into a glass of water, and that it would sort of function in the same way as a crystal ball. And I was like, oh, that's cool. I really liked that.
Like tea leaves reading, etc. Like it would be used.
Yeah, something like that. And I was like, oh, that's so, like, it. I like that because it's so basic. Like, everybody has an egg and a glass of water. And anybody could, like, you know, just, and I, you know, going back to the movie and your experiences as well, Angela, that anybody can kind of, like, be a little witchy, you know? And there's something really great about that. That, like, you can kind of, you don't have to buy a crystal ball, or you don't have to, like, you know, you could just have like a group of people over and just start like a little coven, and it's like just be intimate and share, you know, experiences and laugh and eat some cheese whiz. You know, so
exactly. Well, what's really interesting, the etymology of spell is simply to say something, or like to tell a story. And I just think, like, I love that. I think that we're all practicing witchcraft all the time, because we're all under the spell of our stories, under the spell of what we've constructed from our memories, Fox News, NPR. Like, we're under the spell of stories.
Speak it
every
and make
day.
It so.
Yeah, exactly. That's all it is. That's all it is. Yeah. And so, yeah, we're all just constantly moving through the world as witches.
Yeah. Wow. What? I don't want to say anything more, because that's such a good wrap up.
Angela, was there anything else you wanted to bring to our attention about your upcoming shows, or anything about this? Maybe another movie that you have planned to watch about witches, or...
Oh, gosh. I don't know. I'm reading The Once and Future Witches right now, and I'm thoroughly enjoying it. And then, you know, I, like, watch a lot of TV. Yeah. It's not like I don't, you know.
What's the title of the book with female heroes?
Oh, it's by Maria Tatar. She's a Harvard professor. It's called The 1001. It's like a playoff of Joseph Campbell's 1001 Heroes, or 1001 Faces of a Hero, or something like that.
Okay.
Sorry, I can't remember, but yeah, look up Maria Tatar, Tatar.
We'll link to that.
Yeah, and there's a really great book out by Tashin that just came out on witchcraft.
My friend Edgar. Yeah, my friend Edgar contributed to that book, and I was hoping to have them on the podcast sometime.
Oh yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. Cool. Yeah, there's a lot of contemporary artists in there. It's very cool.
Aaron, you thought we were going to talk about movies, but I think this has turned into a straight up witch podcast.
I think so too. I'm okay with that. I'm okay. We go in that.
Angela, do you have any advice for future guest, because you were saying that you had a little trepidation as we began.
Oh, like who you should invite, you mean? Or
oh no, I mean just advice. Like, you could do that, but I was going to say advice for people that like or might have some hesitancy about.
Oh no, participating. Yeah, like, it's fun. Just do it. You guys are really great interviewers because you just make people feel super comfortable, and you're both really prepared and take a lot of the weight off of the person participating, the guest, you know.
Oh,
so
thanks.
Like, I felt like you could fill in the space if I was feeling a little awkward, so
a ringing endorsement.
Yeah.
It's almost like I went fishing. I didn't, but I do like hearing nice things.
Well, Angela, you were a delight. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good luck with your projects.
Yeah.
And,
well, thank you. Yeah, I'll keep you posted. I'm making some spell paintings right now, so we'll see how that goes. Okay. All right. Thanks, y'all. Have a good night.
Me too.
Yeah. Okay.
Bye.
Just an average horny little devil.
With the witches of Eastwick,
we could do things you haven't any idea.
You know what's going on up in that house?
She says she sees the devil here in Eastwick.